I appreciate the congregation here at Schertz. I always look forward to being able to be with you. I agree with what Brother Hayes said just a few moments ago about the books which are presented each year. Great material. I use my lectureship books from here as one of the commentaries to which I turn most quickly. Always great. I'm honored to have an opportunity to participate in the production of those, and I'm grateful to be able to speak today on Ecclesiastes 3 and 4. Following the two lessons that were presented already today, I sort of have a gloom and doom task at hand. I asked Tim, I said, why'd you do that? I was going to preach sunshine and roses, man. And you've got everybody down. Well, I wasn't really going to preach sunshine and roses because I don't know that you can do that from the book of Ecclesiastes. But you can learn some great lessons which are applicable today as they were in Solomon's day. But let's understand that these things are written from Solomon's viewpoint. They are written from the viewpoint of one who is smarting and has smarted because of sin. Because while he had wisdom, he did not use that wisdom prudently. He did not apply that wisdom to action. And so he suffered. And as he writes this book, and the suggestion has already been made this morning, this book may have been a demonstration of repentance, and I believe so. I think it was a confession of sorts. He's writing this standpoint from the standpoint of somebody who has suffered because of sin. We don't know that he suffered the same way some suffer today because of sin. Some suffer with health problems. Some suffer accidents. Some suffer other difficulties because of sin. But at the very least, he had in him this abiding understanding that he had made his own path difficult. He had hurt himself. The wages of sin is death, but the wages of sin also is suffering. And for Solomon, this suffering was very real, and it contributed to his viewing this life as vanity and vexation. As we see chapters 3 and 4 this morning, we see that coming out, and we see that coming out from this standpoint of the physical life is that which we know, that which we experience. And so there's going to be very little looking forward to the spiritual life and eternity in Solomon's writing. In fact, he begins chapter 3 by talking about this life, by talking about the seasons, the appointed occasions of this life, by talking about the times of this life, literally the nows and whens of this life, the purposes of this life, the pleasures or desires of this life. And you'll notice that I have repeated this life. That is Solomon's concern. These verses apply to man, to what man will do, even to what man must do in this life. These are human things. These are temporal things. These are temporary things, imperfect things, frail things, or in Solomon's vernacular, these are vanity. This does not mean that the things done of man are wholly worthless. In fact, there are things that we must do while we are in our physical frames. But rather, this is spoken of in the beginning of chapter 3 as that which is needful and that which is ordered. To everything in this life, there is an appropriate spot. The man who is wise will judge rightly when he is to do what. The one who is unwise will be laughing at funerals, things of that nature. So what are the appropriate times? Well, this first set of verses has been applied to peace during times of war. In fact, the song "Turn, Turn, Turn," I first became aware of that listening to the birds. "Turn, Turn, Turn." Well, that was a war protest song. It actually had originally been written to protest the Korean War and then the Vietnam conflict. But this is a song which takes Ecclesiastes 3 out of context. Ecclesiastes 3 isn't just about peace. It's about the whole of man's life. It's about the whole of human affairs apart from man's relationship with his God. So this section is focused on the physical world, and it's at odds with it, the eternal and the perfect world and work of God. Physical and temporary existence are what are being discussed. In verse 2, we see that there is a time to be born, or as John Gill said, a time or the hour when women bear children, the time of the woman. There's a time when children are going to be born. By the same token, there is a time when death is going to take place. Now, some have suggested, and John Gill was one of them, that what this is indicating is that that day of death is fixed by the Lord. I don't necessarily agree with that. Now, the Lord knows, but He does not fix when man is going to die. Brother Bland, who is an absolute card, and most of you know that, I'll tell people that are students at the school that if they are in Brother Mosier's class, they have to laugh at his jokes, okay, because they just have to. If they hear Brother Bland tell a joke, they don't have to laugh at it. They're going to, because Brother Bland's jokes are funny. Well, Brother Bland is hilarious. He was talking a few years ago about this idea of fatalism. And you know, Brother Bland flies a great deal. He said, "Well, I sure hope I'm not in the plane when it's the pilot's time to go." And that makes a lot of sense. Well, what that idea that man has a fixed time of death does is it plays right into the hands of the Calvinist. It plays right into the hands of the determinist. Plays right into the hands of the fatalist. If death is predetermined, then how can one say that his life is not? If death is predetermined, is it coincidence or is it providence that brings all these people in the airplane together at exactly the same time when that airplane goes down? And does this not alleviate the murderer of the responsibility, given that the victim was going to die anyway? Or maybe the murderer can say, "I was preordained or foreordained of God to commit this crime." Perhaps even against his own will, he could say that. Or even having his will willed by God. The Scripture teaches that man has free will. We won't belabor that point any further. But understand that as there is birth and death, there is also a now and a when for sowing and for reaping. The sower knows when it is right to put the seeds in the ground. He pulls out his Poor Richard's almanac, and he figures out exactly when, and he knows when it's time to reap, when the fruit is at the proper stage of ripeness. Solomon went on to say, there is a time to kill. Well, murder had been outlawed in Exodus 20, verse 13, and that's what the word "kill" there in that passage means. Killing as a part of warfare, as in the case of Joshua, Deuteronomy 3, 21 and 22, or capital punishment, as in the case of Achan, Joshua 7, 15, those had been continually and justly and consistently practiced by God and those who feared Him. So there's a time to kill, but there's also a time when enemies can treat each other with mercy. Think about the battlefield which is scarred from the battle which has taken place the day before, that there are bodies strewn about that field. Some of those bodies still have life. And you have working together on the battlefield the medics from both sides taking care of both sets of soldiers. It doesn't matter what the uniform is that he's wearing. The medic is going to be concerned that he live. There's a time for healing once that battle is over. There's a time to break down walls as Joshua did in Jericho 6:20. In Joshua 6:20. There's a time to rebuild walls as in the case of Nehemiah and the walls of Jerusalem, Nehemiah 4:6. There's a time to rebuild cities. A time to weep, a time to make lamentation. There's a time to laugh, rejoice. The second part of verse 4 is a little stronger. There's a time to wail, a time to tear the hair and beat the breasts. But then there's also this time to dance, to spring about, to exhibit this great joy. Sadness and happiness, in both their mild and strong forms, are natural for man. In verse 5, there's a time to clear stones as one is preparing to sow in the field. But there are also times for that field to be walled in, maybe to delineate that territory, maybe to protect it from the enemies, to protect it from the wild animals, or even men who might try to do harm to what's walled in. Robert Frost, in his Mending Walls, spoke about good walls making good neighbors. Also in verse 5, there's a time to embrace. Now that word embrace could be as innocent as a hug, but it could also refer to the conjugal embrace. There's a time for husband and wife to come together. But there's likewise a time when people need to be to themselves. 1 Corinthians 7:5 carries the idea that husband and wife don't need to defraud each other except an occasion demand it. Okay, that's the exception. There's a time. Going into verse 6, there's a time to get, a time to have material gain. But there's also a time when that which is gained should be lost. You keep that. When an idle beggar comes wanting what you have, 2 Thessalonians 3:10. That's not saying somebody that will be industrious, somebody that has a genuine need, can't be helped by it. But the one who is just going to waste it, he's going to continue to be prodigal, don't give to him. But there's also a time to give. The liberal soul shall be made fat. He that watereth shall be watered also himself, Proverbs 11, 24 and 25. The nails and winds include a time for rending, a time for tearing the garments in mourning, as Jacob did in Genesis 37, 34. But then when that period of mourning is ended, there's a time to put the garments back together, to sew them up and to move on. There's a time for silence in mourning. We can remember the wisdom of Job's friends was seen in their silence, Job 2:13, Job 13:5. But then there's a time to speak again. Unfortunately, Job's friends didn't know the difference between those two times, so they spoke before they needed to. They shouldn't have spoken again till chapter 42. The book would have been a whole lot shorter, but Job's life might have been a little bit happier for a time. Knowing when and how to speak is a valuable skill. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in pictures of silver, Proverbs 25:11. There's a time to love others, especially when brethren dwell together in unity, Psalm 133:1. And there's a time to not love each other when that unity is broken by sin and the wrongdoing, not the sinner, but the wrongdoing becomes the object of hatred. In a seemingly different line of thought, at the end of verse 8, there's a time to make war. That may be connected to the previous pair of occasions due to the violent side of righteous judgment, Romans 11:22. On the other hand, when victory conditions have been met, there's a time for peace. In verse 9, after this to everything list has been concluded, the question is asked, what profit? What profit hath he that laboreth in that wherein worketh in that wherein he laboreth? The humility of man, the natural state of man, his being lower than God, his being temporal, his being frail, is the idea that's being addressed here. It's being seen in this verse, which ties these seasons or occasions together. After all has been done by man, after man has gone through these occasions, these nows and whens, what does he have to show for it? After all has been done, what gain or what benefit has been accomplished? John Gill said, he has none. Man has no benefit, or so is the inference drawn from what Solomon has said. But let's remember the most important thing here. We're viewing this from the eyes of Solomon. We're viewing this from that physical perspective. This conclusion of Solomon, and what Gill was referring to, this conclusion of Solomon is Solomon's observation. It's not God's. Solomon's thought. Now we go and build upon that idea of the humility of man in verses 10 through 13. Solomon claims to have seen the travail given man by God. And I loved what Tim said earlier, commenting on chapter 1, verse 14. Solomon didn't have all experience. He didn't know everything which had taken place. So understand that he is looking from a limited perspective. He says, I've seen the travail, though. In Ecclesiastes 1:13, he called this sore travail. This sore travail was given for man to be exercised or depressed, pushed down by it. Let's think about that thought for just a moment. Is this life the one for which we ultimately are living? Is this life paradise? No. This life isn't intended to be paradise. Man is going to suffer because this world is not that world. But man doesn't suffer because he's being depressed by God. He suffers because he's subject to physical laws and the result of sin, Romans 5:12. And the doing of sin and the oppression laid upon ones by others, those aren't part of those things to which there is a time and a season. The times and seasons are for those things which man has to do, those things which are part of life and which are perfectly fitting and just as part of life. Verse 11, Solomon makes an interesting concession. He says, God has made everything beautiful in His time. Whether it's God's time or whether it's the time of the thing that's been made beautiful is not consequential. Point is that God has made everything beautiful. Everything is beautiful in a universal statement and therefore must include man himself. Man is beautiful. In fact, in Ecclesiastes 7:29, Solomon acknowledged this. God hath made man upright, but they, man, have sought out many inventions. This means that Solomon should not have been so hard on man and on physical existence in a general sense. For only those things which have been corrupted by man in his sinful selfishness truly are vanity and vexation. Solomon rightly expresses that man cannot find the work that God makes. In Job 38 through 41, that's what Job learned. Job wasn't God. Job wasn't around when God was performing the creative acts. Job didn't understand. And neither do we. And we won't. Because we're not God. Think about the idea of a child. Of course, a child's going to grow up in a way that a man's not going to grow up with in respect to God. But think about the two-month-old, the three-month-old. What sort of vocabulary does the two-month-old child have? Well, none. At least not that he's able to express. By this time, he has learned to recognize certain words, undoubtedly. He probably knows mama. He may know daddy. He may know some other simple words. But when mommy or daddy speak to him, while he can't understand their vocabulary, what does he do nonetheless? He smiles because he's hearing the voice of his parents. He's hearing the voice of mom. He's hearing the voice of dad. We're in a position where we don't understand everything of God. He's speaking a vocabulary which is God's. But you know what we do when we hear his voice? We smile. We don't have to understand his vocabulary. We know he's our Father. That which we do know, that which we are capable of understanding, we obey because he's our Father. And we smile when we hear his voice. That's the way that we ought to look at verse 11. In verse 12, Solomon affirms that there's no good in man. There's no innate, no, pardon the double negative, there's no not given good in man. Well, we can compare that with the expression of Jesus. There is none good but one, that is God, Matthew 19:17. However, even in this, it is fit for man to rejoice and to do good in this life. Verse 13, it is also fit that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of his labor. Now, we may criticize Solomon for saying that, but I don't know that we need to overly criticize Solomon for what he says there in verse 13, because God does not want man to be miserable. In fact, the capacity to eat and to drink and to enjoy is the gift of God. Solomon perhaps had learned this of his father. Psalm 128:2, for thou shalt eat the labor of thine hands, happy shalt thou be, and it shall be well with thee. There's nothing wrong with enjoying the things of this life that are good, that are wholesome, that contribute to the physical existence. As long as we appreciate the one from whom these things come. When we begin to think that these are the product of ourselves, or when we begin to seek after that which isn't from God and glory in that, that's when we have sinned. But it's okay to enjoy certain things in this life. We go on to verses 14 and 15, and we see the immutability of the work of God. Even that which may have been misidentified as a complete weakness in humanity, though it be truly good and beneficial, is nothing when contrasted with the nature of God and His volition and His action. In verse 15, we drawing the thoughts of 14 and 15 together, we see that things don't change. Built upon that thought is this: everything answers to God. Everything has answered to God. Everything does answer to God. Everything will answer to God. Which leads us to the following verses, 16 and 17, which deal with the inequity of man. God is sovereign. He is holy. He is righteous in all respects. Man's not. we might expect to have justice, to have equity, to see holiness in our court system, in our politicians, in our schools, in our homes. But we don't. Why not? Because they're not God. Men are going to be unjust, Solomon says. But God's not. Here's the problem. Where one would expect justice, equity, and holiness, they're missing, and that's why we're in the shape that we're in today. What has our highest court in our land done recently? It's made immorality legislated law. You can do immorality and be perfectly fine with it. And that's not the first one. I mean, we could list many occasions in our nation's or other nations' history where immorality or sin has been legalized. You go to the 7-Eleven, what do you see? Well, you see alcohol lining a whole wall, maybe more than that. Is that any better or worse than homosexuality? No, both are sinful. Our government says, hey, it's okay to drink. Hey, it's okay to do this. The inequity of man, because man is not living by and doing God's law, neither does he have the appreciation for justice that God has. God, and only God, is capable of truly judging and wholly, righteously judging. Only God is capable of knowing every aspect of every facet of every case. He knows the nature of every one of those nows and whens that appear between verses 1 and 8. And he does so operating on his own schedule. Solomon concludes there's a similarity then, since man's not like God, there's a similarity between man and beast. Now that's an interesting thought. Man and beast have something in common. Now, Solomon is not saying that man came from the beasts in the way that the evolutionist is going to argue. Rather, remember, Solomon is looking from the physical perspective. He's not concerning himself here with the spiritual perspective. So what he sees is after a given amount of time, the beast is lying on the ground dead. And after a given amount of time, the man is lying on the ground dead. Sometimes we call death the great equalizer. Death makes the rich and the poor equal. Death makes the popular and the unpopular equal. You know what? When we die, we're going to be just as popular as whoever the latest TV star is. We're going to be just as rich as Bill Gates, because those things have no place in the ground, if you will. Solomon takes that a step further and he says this great equalizer equalizes man and beast. Well, that's a short-sighted approach to this existence, because Solomon is only looking at the physical aspect. Solomon's conclusion, verse 22, is since that's the case, man needs to just rejoice in his own works. He's viewing the physical world with death being the end. He might have had the idea that we used to see on bumper stickers, he who dies with the most toys wins. Well, at death, those toys don't matter. All right, is that 3 minutes? 5 minutes. Oh, cool, I've got 5 minutes to go through chapter 5. Chapter 4, rather. I won't get to chapter 5. All right, chapter 4. Solomon recognizes in verses 1 and following that people suffer due to the oppressions of others. But that's not God's fault. In fact, what we see in verse 1 there that he says, I returned and considered all the oppression. They have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors there was power. They had no comforter. Well, we understand that Solomon had no appreciation here of Jesus. They didn't have Jesus. We do. Job had an appreciation of Jesus. Job said, I know that my Redeemer liveth. Job says there is going to be somebody that stands in the latter day. There is going to be a Goel. There is going to be a daysman between me and God. Solomon doesn't see that. Solomon says, you die. While you're alive, you're oppressed. I'm curious, who made Solomon feel oppressed? He's the king. But he's speaking as one who is feeling this. He says in verse 2, wherefore I praise the dead which are already dead. This sounds a lot like Job's attitude. When Job said, I wish I could have been one who died in the womb. Or, I wish the knees had prevented me. What the idea there actually is, I wish the knees of the one who accepted me when I came out of my mother's womb had accidentally dropped me and I had died. Okay? He wanted not to have lived. Solomon says it's better not to have lived. Or it's better to still be in the womb. Because you don't have to experience what's being experienced in verse 2. Verse 3, better is he than both they which hath not yet been. Then he looked at all the work done under the sun. And he said it's vanity and vexation. Let's go to verse 6 for just a moment. I'm skipping verse 5 because we're going to come back there. Better is an handful with quietness than both the hands full with travail and vexation of spirit. It's easy to take that verse out of context. What is that verse saying? Well, that verse is the thought of the fool of verse 5. The fool foldeth his hands together, eateth his own flesh. Maybe a bit of scientific foreknowledge that what the fool does when he's not working is he's consuming his own fat. And so he's eating off of himself, his own physical body. But while he's there, he's thinking, boy, it sure is better to have a little bit being able to sit here with my arms crossed than to have a whole lot but have to work for it. That's the way we need to look at verse 6. Again, in verse 7, vanity is what he saw under the sun. Verses 9 through 12, sometimes we apply that to the marriage relationship. I would hesitate to do that, at least from the standpoint of what Solomon was writing. It was pointed out this morning that Solomon had 700 wives. And what we see in verse 2 is a threefold cord. It's not a 702-fold cord that's quickly broken. He's not talking about marriage. He's talking about unity. He's talking about synergy. But not this 702-fold cord being quickly broken. Verse 13, he says it's better to be a poor and a wise child than an old and a foolish king. That's Solomon referring to himself. It says it's better to have this innocence, to have this naivety. It's better to be one who doesn't come from that background than to have grown up in the position that I did, wanting to exercise this vanity. But you go to verses 15 and 16. I considered all the living which walk under the sun, with the second child that shall stand in his stead. No end of all the people, even of all them that have been before them. They also that come after him shall not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and vexation of spirit. Another one of those seven times that expression's used. Solomon concludes these two very gloomy chapters by saying, when I die, somebody else is just going to come into the picture. My second son's going to take what I've got. Just another step in the process. That gloominess which was introduced in the first two lessons this morning continues as chapter 4 closes. Thank you for your kind attention.